Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, seriously, we've got a month yet. Does it really matter there's no deal on the fiscal cliff right now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 30th of November. Good to have you with us. A month, everybody. 31 days. That's what we got till the end of the world. Or not. The fiscal cliff and its discontents are where we begin today here for our weekly wrapper. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. They are in our studios in Washington, D.C., the site of everything that's going on right now. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, I put it to you, sir, that question I opened with, does it matter that we don't have a deal yet? There is much backing and forthing.
It matters a little bit. There will be a deal on the fiscal cliff. It will be either late this year or very early next year because neither side can stomach the political consequences of not having a deal. But we have this rather awkward dilemma here where on one level we shouldn't panic because we know in the end this will get resolved in a way that's maybe disappointing but not necessarily disastrous. But until people in the real world actually freak out, Congress won't feel enough pressure about the real-world consequences to resolve this. So
okay.
I wish there were a way to get past that.
Great point. And Neela, I wanted to ask you about this. There is now so much negotiating on this thing going on in public. Speaker Boehner, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, the President of the United States, they are all coming out and making these public statements, watching the market go up and down and up and down, and doing it absolutely in front of the markets with everybody watching.
They're doing some of it in front of the markets. They've been masterful at really simplifying this deficit reduction talk to taxes and spending.
Yeah.
There's a lot more going on than that, but we're not hearing about it. And let's remember that markets are psychological in nature.
Yes,
and so all of these press releases do have this jarring effect on markets. And what they're not telling us about the mortgage interest rate deduction that may be on the table, or the fact that there are trillions of dollars in our 401ks and RIAs right now that have never been taxed and under current law will never be, that everything is now on the table and subject to negotiation. That's what we're not hearing about. That's what's kind of frightening.
All right. Well, Sudeep, if negotiations happen in a forest and there's nobody there to hear it, are they really happening? I mean, you know, what is happening? Is something happening behind the scenes? Do you believe
something
that?
Is happening behind the scenes, and I'm not sure it's all that different from what's happening in public. Today we learned that the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, he said he laughed out loud when Tim Geithner presented the White House's opening bid. And that was in a private meeting that he later disclosed in public. So it's obviously still very early in the process, but the incentives are stacked against either side blinking too early.
Neela, go ahead. I hear the sharp intake of breath.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what we're missing here is a counteroffer from the Republicans. The Obama administration put forward a take it or leave it offer. It's definitely a strong, you know, proposal. And we're not hearing a lot on the other side about what the counteroffer will be. And we need that for the negotiations to continue.
All right. On a tangent here, this idea or this issue of the debt ceiling, we had this fight last year. It is now being sort of roped into these negotiations. Are we going to have to do that all over again in February or March when the Treasury Department says we can't borrow any more money, Neela?
I think it looks like that. And I think it's the height of political dysfunction to hold the economy hostage every several months while this is being negotiated. I think it's a good idea to end this practice, but I'm not sure that's going to happen.
And
so
I actually think it's really useful that we're discussing the debt ceiling and the failures that the debt ceiling caused last year to our economy. If we look at this problem, I actually think of Congress kind of like kindergarten. They get grades sometimes. for behavior like you would in kindergarten. And the public is looking at this process in Congress and grading them, because that is ultimately what could affect consumer confidence and business confidence. And if Congress can't figure out a way to deal with the most basic functions of government, then they're going to give a low grade, and people are going to have less confidence about Congress dealing with other more significant challenges that are coming ahead.
That sums up the argument. Markets thrive on confidence, right, and governments on credibility, and both are at risk right now.
Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. She's in Washington along with Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you on Wall Street today. A little of this, a little of that. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We're in day four of a strike that has effectively shut down one of the biggest cargo terminals here on the West Coast. Nothing is moving at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach as the Longshoremen's Union protests what it says is job outsourcing. About 6,000 trucks, $1 billion in cargo every day is going nowhere, which will soon start to be felt in businesses downstream in the supply chain. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Vinnie Wilkes is not one of the workers on strike. He loads and unloads trucks with goods from container ships. But when he showed up at his job today, they told him there wasn't any work.
I'm very worried. I have three children that I may not have a Christmas behind what they're doing here.
The boxes Wilkes would have loaded aren't here because 10,000 workers went on strike in solidarity with 600 clerks who work for the shipping lines and cargo terminals.
The problem has come down to jobs disappearing.
Craig Merrilees is a spokesperson for the union. He says this is not a strike about wages. The clerks are well paid. In fact, longshore unions are one of the few in the country that still have a strong presence in the workplace. But Merrilees says dozens of clerical jobs have been outsourced overseas and to non-union workers. The cargo companies say they haven't moved any jobs. 4 days in, shipping lines will have to make difficult decisions about rerouting their container ships to ports in Mexico or further up the West Coast. Brooks Bentz is a partner in a supply chain management company.
The difficulty is in not fully understanding the magnitude of the disruption.
Bentz says the stoppage at the port is just the beginning. Chris Lytell, executive director of the Port of Long Beach, says the effects of the strike are already being seen outside the borders of the port.
Trains are starting to stack up. You've got thousands of truck drivers now that aren't working, that would normally work the port.
That means those trucks and trains aren't carrying goods to thousands of businesses. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
No matter the port it comes into, a lot of the cargo that moves around this country eventually winds up in warehouses and on delivery trucks on its way to you, especially this time of year. And yet, a bunch of companies that deal with holiday retail madness say this year they can't find enough people to work at their fulfillment centers or drive their delivery trucks. There are thousands of jobs right now in places like Kentucky, New Jersey, and New Hampshire working at UPS or Amazon, at least through Christmas, and then maybe wind up back on unemployment again. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
An opportunity for the next 30 days to put on UPS Brown, the classic uniform of a UPS driver. Well, a seasonal driver's helper, anyway.
UPS is hiring part-time package handlers. All shifts, especially night and sunrise.
UPS Brown, not your color? How about Kelly Green? Kelly Services, the temp agency, is also hunting.
General warehouse positions, pickers, packers, leads, managers, inventory control.
John Ritchie of Kelly Services in Louisville, Kentucky, says he has plenty of these jobs. At UPS, Matthew Lavery says they're recruiting in Kentucky, Texas, New Hampshire, also New Jersey. After Superstorm Sandy, some people have taken cleanup jobs that pay better. Lavery says UPS needed 55,000 workers, 10% more than last year.
A little bit of an uptick in the economy, so we have more competition out there right now looking for seasonal employees.
Now, these jobs pay just above minimum wage, and they end in a month. Makes you wonder, are people on unemployment holding out for something better? Maurice Emsalem of the National Employment Law Project doesn't think so.
In most situations, workers, when they get into, kind of a retail warehouse position, they're going to go off unemployment and then go back on after the job is over.
Emsalem thinks people on unemployment are more likely to take these seasonal jobs, partly because the rules say they have to, partly because when they earn additional income, it can make their unemployment checks bigger when they're out of work again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Silicon Valley can be a killer when it comes to relationships, what with all that money and power changing hands. It's high stakes, high drama, and when it falls apart, the breakups are high profile. Which brings me to one of high tech's most closely watched relationships, Facebook and the social gaming site Zynga. After 2 years of mostly money-making bliss, the companies say it's time to give each other some space. They say they'll still be friends, but you know how that usually goes. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
When Facebook and Zynga promised to be exclusive 2 years ago, Facebook had millions of users, but was still trying to figure out how to make money. Zynga knew how to make money. It does it by selling virtual goods in its games, but needed more users. Arvind Bhatia is an analyst at Stern AG.
Both of them grew up together, and they both were benefiting from each other's businesses.
And so the two companies made a commitment. Among other things, Facebook promised to promote Zynga's games, like Farmville, over those of other companies. And Zynga basically promised to launch new games like Mafia Wars on Facebook first. In their honeymoon period, about 15% of Facebook's revenues came from Zynga, and Zynga made 80% of its money on Facebook. But lately, Zynga's revenues have been falling, and Facebook's getting a wandering eye.
What has happened is Zynga's own business seems to have peaked, and Facebook obviously wants to see growth in that business, and so they are looking for other partners.
And so Bhatia believes Facebook gave Zynga the let's just be friends talk.
Well, I think it was the other way around.
Daniel Ernst is an analyst at Hudson Square Research. He says it wasn't Zynga that got dumped.
Everyone's focused on the negatives to Zynga, but the reality is this actually gives them a lot more opportunity.
Ernst says, like everything else, social gaming is going mobile. And in that space, Apple's App Store and Google Play are the catches. And now, Zynga is free to date them with no strings attached. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, look, we do a show about competitive beard growing. Who knew that was a television series?
Yeah, not me, man. Not me. But first, let's do the numbers. After spending much of the day in negative territory, stocks ended pretty much where they started. The Dow Industrials inched up 3 points, a fraction of 1%, closed at 13,025. The NASDAQ off a point, a sliver of 1%, ended at 3,010. The S&P 500 crept up less than a single point, finished at 1,416 for the month. And yes, it is over. The Dow dropped a 0.5%. The NASDAQ picked up 1.1%. The S&P 500 added about a third of 1%. Investors were heartbroken with Zynga over its breakup with Facebook. Shares of the social gaming site rode the Cityville elevator down 6% today. Shares of Facebook already on the rebound picked up about 2.5% today. Shares of Walmart added a bit more than 1%, about 1.2% today, even as it was named a defendant in a suit filed by temporary workers here in Southern California, charging wage fraud and other violations. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Anyone looking for a new car wrapped up under the tree? Automakers are slated to release November sales figures. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton travels to Prague, her first stop on a 5-day tour that also includes Brussels, Dublin, and Belfast. And on December 3rd, 1947, a streetcar named Desire opened on Broadway with Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. The drought this past summer baked parts of the Midwest. It did a number on farm crops, and it made life hard for ranchers out there, too. And we are not done yet, because the Mississippi River is feeling the effects of all that missing rainfall. The river is at near record lows, which is bad news, really bad news, for those who make their living on the water. Austin Golding owns, with his family, Golding Barge Lines out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So how low is the river now, sir?
Well, what we're reaching is a stage where within a, if we don't get any rain in a matter of weeks, the river between St. Louis and Cairo, Illinois, the upper Mississippi River, will have to be shut down because there's not a navigable channel. So I'd say we're reaching critical stage at this point.
How long have you been doing this, Mr. Golden?
I have been in the business for 26 years, but I've been getting paid for four. I am the third generation of this company, and I'm here with my brother, my dad, my mom, and my grandfather actually started the company in the mid-60s.
You ever seen it this bad?
You know, I think we have seen droughts comparable, but for the prolonged period of time this one's taking place, no. This is, I think will be the longest and most serious drought we've seen yet.
I imagine if you can't load the barges as heavily because the water's low. I mean, this is all about payload and money in your pocket, right?
It is, and in a broader sense, it's about the amount of product that's shipped out to the American consumer. As we all know, St. Louis is a huge hub for a lot of different products that come and get distributed by bulk cargo throughout the country. So not only is this making it more troublesome for only my industry, but it's going to make life more expensive for an average American citizen for a long period of time to come.
What do you carry mostly on your barges?
We carry just refined petroleum products. So any type of refined petrochemical and petroleum, that's what we carry.
But others carry grains and coal and you name it. It goes up and down that river.
You better believe it. Every type of commodity you can put your hands on or think of is moved by bulk on this river.
Is the Army Corps of Engineers involved in any way that you know of?
Yes, they are.
What are they doing, do you know?
Well, we're kind of ingrained in a little bit of a discussion here with them about whether or not to release more water out of the Missouri River. Of course, we want to see that happen, and they have a different opinion. So right now, we'd really like to see some congressional and governmental override and to get some water released via the Missouri River so that we don't have this critical stage from St. Louis south.
Let me make sure I understand. There actually is water upstream in the Missouri River that you guys could get your hands on conceivably. How does that work?
Well, it's all held back by a lock and dam system. They're facing a critical situation up there also. They have their own factors they're trying to protect. But right now what we're trying to do is keep commerce moving on the inland waterway system.
And how long does it take you to get up and down from, I don't know, wherever you're going to wherever you're going? What's your average trip?
My average trip is probably between 3 days to a week. Sometimes they can go a little longer depending on where you load from and where your discharge port is. But, you know, within a week we can get most places.
Do you get to get out and do any of the fun stuff, or are you stuck in an office?
When I can, I blast myself out of here. I flip all the paperwork over and act like it's not there and get out there. It's an all hands on deck type atmosphere and type organization we have. Everybody here knows just about how to do every job we have.
Austin Golding, he's in Vicksburg, Mississippi. He runs a company called Golding Barge Lines. Thanks a lot for your time.
Hey, thank you.
There's one main thing the new Chinese leadership in Beijing has to worry about: keeping the 1.3 billion people who make up the world's second biggest economy happy. And like people everywhere, that happiness is not all about money. Our correspondent Rob Schmitz is in the middle of a series about the Chinese economy, about the people and about the places that make it work. They are stories from a single street in Shanghai called the Street of Eternal Happiness. And today's installment is about exactly that: happiness in bed. Here's Rob.
On the Street of Eternal Happiness, number 342, there's a shop that stands out among its noodle stand neighbors. Its Chinese name is Jianbian Youxi. It literally translates to pillow side games. It's a toy shop for adults. Shop manager Chen Yiyi says sex toys are big business in China. The short, bubbly woman in her 30s manages this shop along with four other stores in Shanghai. Each of them makes as much as $3,000 a day. Beijing doesn't keep official statistics, but state media report China has more than 200,000 sex shops competing for billions of dollars in revenue each year. China's biggest sex shop emporium is a four-story mall here in Shanghai. Chen says it's clear why these shops are so popular.
Many Chinese don't know much at all about sex and reproductive health. Most of our customers come here because they're curious.
Chen says it's not that there's a lack of sex in China. This is the world's most populous country, after all. It's just that China's conservative culture makes it difficult to educate people about sexual health.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
Let's
This hit song from Salt-N-Pepa urged Americans to talk more openly about sex during the height of the AIDS crisis 20 years ago. In China, says Chen, the problem is nobody talks about sex. Parents don't talk to their kids about it. Schools don't do a good job at teaching it. And that leaves people like her, managers of sex shops, to step in as educators.
We have no choice. I remember one of my first customers was a very pretty girl who came in with a Louis Vuitton bag on her shoulder. She looked rich and happy, but once we began to talk, she started to cry. She said her husband was wealthy and handsome, but in the bedroom, he had no idea what foreplay was or how to do much of anything.
Chen says she gives advice to customers like this all the time. And this is just one of the many things that sets apart sex shops in China from those in the U.S., says Richard Berger, author of Behind the Red Door, Sex in China. The first rule of thumb in a Chinese sex shop is no pornography. It's illegal in China.
Sex stores aren't presented in China as places for titillation. They're presented as places for solutions.
Solutions brought to you in part by the government, which approves these shops and treats them as healthcare providers, says Berger.
The Chinese government sees these shops as a way to make its citizens healthy, happy, and content. They believe that when people are having a healthy sex life, they have a more functional family that adds to social stability, and that in turn adds to greater tolerance of the government.
In China, as in the U.S., sex has been political for some time. A song from the late 1960s in China urges people to fight against bourgeois tendencies. Bourgeois tendencies like sex, says Berger. While the counterculture movement in the U.S. encouraged free love, across the planet, Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution urged the opposite.
Sex was totally prohibited. You could not express sexual feelings if you weren't married because that was seen as a sign of Western spiritual pollution. This went on for years, and many felt that a piece of their life had been stolen away from them.
And that's why boys do it. Bees do it.
And on the Street of Eternal Happiness, sex shop manager Chen Yiyi stands among shelves of blow-up dolls, French ticklers, and other colorful accessories. She tells me it doesn't matter whether her customers buy any of these things. She says she just wants to help them, comfort them, reacquaint them with a natural part of their lives. And if they leave her shop happier than when they arrived, she says her job is done. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's an interactive map of the Street of Eternal Happiness, some videos, and more details from Rob's reporting online. It's marketplace.org. If you're a fan of reality TV and you're looking for something to do tonight, might I suggest the Discovery Channel? It will be, I promise, pure gold, quite literally.
Six down-on-their-luck men from the lower 48 risked it all. To strike it rich. Yee-haw! In the wilds of Alaska.
Gold Rush is the name of the show, just one of so many very niche reality shows. We asked Marketplace's Eve Trow to figure out why we're watching such specific slices of life.
The show Deadliest Catch, about fishermen in icy Alaskan waters, and Ice Road Truckers, about, well, the name says it, have been pretty big hits for the company Original Productions. Philip Siegel is president. He sees no limit to the human endeavors that can make good TV.
I mean, look, we do a show about competitive beard growing. Who knew that was a television series?
Bearding is a sport.
Whisker wars.
Growing and cultivating and styling one's beard for the purpose of competing.
But it is getting harder to sell these shows to networks.
It used to be where we could show you some great character interviews and just tell you a story and they'd say, go do that.
Now, the networks want to see polished scenes of the characters doing the thing, the chainsaw sculpting.
Meet the saw dogs.
Or swamp beast hunting.
He just got one big red eye.
That takes more time and money up front from the production company. Networks usually commit to 6 or 10 episodes of shows like these from the get-go. How do they do audience-wise?
Well, you have to look at the ratings on a cumulative basis.
Larry Gearbrandt follows TV ratings at Media Valuation Partners. He says these way out there reality cable shows build an audience over time.
because they run the shows over and over again, and they frequently run them in marathons.
And when advertisers buy time on possum groomers or tightrope welders or whatever, they know they're getting audience eyeballs bit by bit. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, following on Mitt Romney's lunch yesterday with the president. Maybe some of you have heard this before, but it came as news to me that Governor Romney does like him some McDonald's. So, in fact, did his father, the late George Romney. It turns out that Romney the Elder had done some business dealings years back with Ray Kroc, who, of course, founded the chain. And in return, Kroc had given him a card entitling him to free burgers for life. Came with fries and a drink as well. Pretty good deal. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow Industrials picked up 3 points today. That's a fraction of 1%. Closed at 13,025. The NASDAQ off a point, a sliver of 1%, 3,010. The number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 crept up a quarter point, barely a percentage point at all. Finished at 1416. For the month, by the way, the Dow off about a half percent. The NASDAQ up a percent. The S&P 500 added a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, life after winning the lottery.
I live off of a fixed income and I budget my money. All my extravagant spending, I did that when I first won, such as paying off my house, student loans, because I had three of them.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.